On RSN 927's Racing Pulse, welcome to The Verdict.
It was confirmed, Terry Bailey resigning as the Chief Steward of Racing Victoria to take up a post at Singapore.
It's the worst kept secret in racing. I think I first reported it back in February. Terry Bailey is an absolutely intriguing character to me.
If Racing Victoria want to be actually concerned about the welfare of participants, cut it back. It's not a sign of weakness to run a race meeting of six races, is it?
I think it's tremendous. We need to keep competing on the global stage.
He said, that was off the record. I said, no, what you said to me was, I've got to be careful what I say. So I assumed that you weren't going to tell me
the really, really good stuff.
So he told me the really good stuff, and I assume, I wonder what he's leaving out. So I wrote it.
Is this going to be a good year or a bad year on the punt?
Bad year. It'll get better, though. We've got plenty of time for it to be a good year on the punt, as the Danny Power I've known for 25 years. He's not many good years on the punt. How are you, Dan?
I've had a few.
You're actually quite a conservative punter.
Used to be Leviathan. Used to bet my wages.
Nah, well, relative to your wages, Leviathan.
Yeah, that's Leviathan.
Yeah. Okay.
God, if you walk out of the trots on a Saturday night and you haven't got a bean and you've got to get through to pay the following Thursday. I had a guy at the Truth who used to snip me every payday for $5, which was a fair bit. You could, you know, 17 cents a pot of beer. So he sent me, and then he'd pay me on Monday because he had a little rort where somebody owed him money every Monday. But it'd get him through the weekend for drinking money without his wife knowing.
Well, and it was all smoke and mirrors back then because Benny Dorries, who joins us. Hey, Benny. How old are you, Ben?
I'm 41.
How old are you, Dan, without giving?
64.
So I'm more on Benny's side, but in between.
You look more on my side.
I remember, but the old days, Ben, you won't remember this because you're a child of the ATM era and all that sort of stuff. The very early days. When you went to the credit union at work, we both worked at the same place, you had to sort of map out your weekend. And then if you got it horribly wrong, that's when the snipping started. We were all mad snippers because we all had no re-access to money.
I'm not too old for that. I remember vividly when I started the newspapers getting rent assistance, and it came in the form of a cheque, and I couldn't wait to get to the bank to bank it. Unfortunately, it took 3 days to clear. So 3 days later, I was standing outside there, straight at the casino with a tab. Gee, they were good days.
Terrific. Snip was huge.
Snip was massive.
Shane Teverland snipped for practice.
He would win just big and then,
he would find out who won
just
on the day.
Just to keep you honest.
Even if he'd won, he would still snip the winner to say, he'd mumble as he walked away with 20 in his key, he said, he's got to learn that he's going to be, if he wins, he's going to be snipped.
And I agree with Shane. I think lessons, you know, you do need those brutal lessons. And one of the ones on Saturday at Caulfield was just because a jockey's having one of those unbelievable runs doesn't mean it's going to necessarily continue when you need it to. Mm. And we had the tab create a Craig Williams market if he rode one winner, two winners, three, four. And the price at four or more was $17 and it was backed in and they got a decent pool on it. Because I think a lot of people were thinking, hang on a minute, everyone's tipped him to win the first two, Jukebox will win, that thing Relito will win. So in the end, he had one winner, it was the last race. So
I wonder what the price would have been for no winners.
That was the market that we should have created, but we didn't.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Never assume anything with a jockey in form. Hey, Benny, Wayne Hawke said something interesting before, and it was something I've always agreed with, is the gap between carnival time and off-season time is never been more narrow for the quality of horses. Prize money's up, and you look at horses that have been winning like Nature Strip and Brutal, and we're talking about Brutal versus Estajab, the Golden Slipper winner, and as much as he said, Estajab would be the superior horse, there's not that winter form versus carnival form gap that there used to be because of good prize money?
Absolutely. And you know what I've really noticed? I'm a bit of a Johnny come lately down here, just been living down here for 6 months. But I tell you what, there's some good horses being produced. What about that thing Gold Mag that won at Sandown last Wednesday?
Yep.
Won by 5 lengths, running away, if you don't mind. And good form judges have sort of said to me that that is the best midweek win that they have seen since Weekend Hustler, I think, was produced in town in 2007. So, I mean, we're seeing horses that are being talked about. I mean, he's got a long way to go before he's Weekend Hustler. But horses being talked about at that ilk, just at a dusty old sort of midweek meeting. So
but what's changed, Dan? Like, when we were 25 years ago, it was winter and carnival. But now it's sort of all seasons now, isn't it?
I think you'll find that trainers, especially in the last probably 10 years it started, and maybe a bit earlier, are now delaying their two-year-olds. And for that reason, I think they're allowing a little bit more maturity, and I think that's resulting. Gold Mag's nearly a four-year-old, so he's going to he probably will take a while before he stretches on. But I find in winter, and I think I said this last time I was on, great great for two-year-old form. You'll find there's a lot of two-year-olds that are just late developers, like Brutal. We had that that filly in Sydney. Did you see it? The smart missile filly that, of Chris Lees. How good was she? I've got it written down here.
And how good is smart missile going? He's a stallion that everyone thought was completely hopeless. Everyone hated them, and all of a sudden they're just winning left, right and centre, aren't they?
Yeah, and just the way it goes. And some stallions are just late develops. Fox Wedge is another one that seems to be... He's yet to sire that extra really good colt, which was probably holding him back, but... there's some good stallions. But I love winter form. And I think, did you see, there was a horse on Saturday at Queensland in Sunshine Coast called Zoo Style. Now, that's rating through the roof.
Yep.
Tony Golan's really trying to temper the expectations there, but I think even he's getting pretty excited. He's had a bit of a, probably a quieter time, Tony, the last few months. But I'll tell you what, to have one like that in the barn would be pretty handy.
It's a seriously good, and it wins, it's a big leggy, out of a German mare, so you think it's going to train a little bit, even though it's by Zoostar. And it just when you see them win like that, you just think, yeah, it's pretty good.
Well, and you know now too, because I'm not saying the ratings are everything, but the, you know, the above and below benchmarks, we can attribute a rating to a performance now, where you can't just say, oh, it's just winter form. You can say, aha, well, hang on. These things all stack up against it that give it some sort of sense of
where it sits. Your eye.
Yeah.
There's some stats that you can add to it. And I remember when I worked with Mark Reed around 2000, and Thorn Park won a midweek race, I think at Canterbury, first start. And the ratings guys at Mark Reed, and he was essentially the guru ratings guy at the time, they declared that that's the highest rating midweek 2-year-old winner that, you know, sort of they'd ever had on their database, which went back to about 1990, 1980. And it proved to be right. And so even then, the right people who had the knowledge had the access to the stats that suggested a horse was better than norm.
And they used it to their advantage back then, because there weren't a lot of people doing the same thing. No. So they had a little bit of upside, didn't they? Hey, we'll round off the weekend's racing, and Benny Allen had a double at Caulfield, just to remind us that he's very much part of that super group of young riders. And one thing, there's two things. I want to talk about this amazing win at Cowra, but the racing.com... introduction of the drone shot on a regular Saturday has given us this lovely extra perspective and lovely panoramas over Melbourne and all that. But didn't it highlight the power of Voodoo Lad's last 200 metres? That shot, it was like just that angle on it, the way he tore away. There's another example, Voodoo Lad at this time of year. And
hindsight's a wonderful thing. He's run second in a Sir Rupert Clark and second in a new market. He probably had 5 lengths on him, really.
What do we make of Jukebox there, lads? I thought Craig Williams got off and said, look, it was a tick. He was off the scene for quite a while.
Average.
I thought so too.
Well, the wraps and that. But full credit to Mick Sharkey on Friday. Let's have a real look at this horse's form and go through it. The horses he was beating have never been sighted since. He got beaten by Catchy. Yes, okay, that's an okay form line, but he didn't beat Catchy, you know, and Catchy was up and down after that.
I think a lot of people, though, gravitated to what Kieran Maher said last week when actually I did an interview for him with Racenet and a few others did too, and he sort of said, look, at one point, Jukebox was right up there with Merchant Navy, and everyone knows what Merchant Navy's done. So I think people were looking at that race and thinking, well, if this thing's half as good as Merchant Navy, it should be winning this race.
I think he's a raw. I think he's got plenty of ability, and he's obviously had issues. I didn't think his trials were anything super either. I was sort of half potting him. I thought if Voodoo Lad was anywhere near right, I wish I was in betting mode, but I wasn't.
And the way the race was always going to play out, and I had a good chat to Eyebrows, Eustace, on race morning, and it wasn't going to be one of those soft kill scenarios for the classy colt coming back where he's going to sit up and sprint away. There was really strong speed, so it was going to stretch out the first up capabilities of a horse like him. And who was it always going to suit? Voodoo Lad.
Yeah. And plus the small field helped. He wasn't 10 lengths off them, he was 5, and it made a big difference being 5.
I think something I learnt there too, I think innkeepers probably a bit more talented than everyone's, you know, perhaps thought. I mean, wet tracks are obviously the go there, but ran quite well, I thought, hung on for second, so something to beat when that horse finds a wet track.
Absolutely. There's a good tweet coming through about Four Corners. We're going to get to that in a minute, but I love these freaky things that happen. And normally, Cowra on a Saturday, would it be even on the blue Sky 2, or would it even make Sky?
It was on Sky One.
It was on Sky One.
Because I saw it in the press box at Caulfield live, so I'm assuming that would have been Sky One.
Well, tell us what you saw, Benny.
Oh, it was just absolutely extraordinary. And you're right, Matt. I love these stories. Sometimes racing at this time of year does get a little bit ho-hum, doesn't it? You know, the sort of second-tier or third-tier horses. But this little apprentice jockey completely lost.
Akira Kajia?
Yep. Just lost the irons and sort of nowhere near the finishing line.
Like, at the start, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, pretty much. And the horse just, you would have given 1,000 to 1, wouldn't you? 300 metres out. You thought this horse is just going to run around the outside. And
was it where was it in the market?
Yeah, it was the favourite.
It was the favourite.
So I tell you what, it should have been the favourite too, shouldn't it?
And so he loses his irons, Danny, and Akira, and sort of ends up getting to the outside, and up the straight you thought it's not going well enough despite that, but somehow manages to win the race.
I think if he could have pulled it up, he would have pulled it up, yeah. But he couldn't. He lost control, so he just let it run. I Googled in my many hours of research for the show, I Googled Trove to find out, you know, jockey mishaps, and then I found losing irons. I found this Jay Duncan from about 1936 in Sydney who had the same issue but didn't win. And it said he spent 3 days recuperating in Katoomba. Katoomba. He'd be back next week to ride.
Well, the funny thing about Akira was if you continued the tape, he then falls off when they go to the outside of the track. So,
but I think he got up pretty quickly when they told him he'd won.
Well,
it didn't look like it won either, did it? Like,
you'd probably have some sore spots from that you might need a radar.
That's what I meant about the bloke had to recuperate it.
So we all started racking our brains, and I remember King Marauding won a sires at Flemington after the saddle slipped, and he sort of was a great riding performance. It might have even been Greg Hall or Mick Dittman. I can't remember who the jockey was.
Trained by Jim Marconi at the time, and I can't remember.
Was it Gouch even? Maybe. Could have been Gouch.
Yeah.
What have you? And there was the Kiwi Jumps jockey a few weeks ago, which is the most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
When the horse stumbled and he sort of fell off and got back on and it won.
Well, there was one similar to that, Kiwi jockey Bryce Revelle at Great Eastern in 1993, fell off touch judge early, climbed back on, went around the field, led by 20, came to the last, and it tossed him 15 feet in the air, and he landed on its neck, and it carried him across the line, and he won. And he said afterwards, he said, I just knew I was gone. But he said, somehow where I landed, I happened to land on the horse. And so that was one. And, of course, Simon Mills at Oakbank.
Yep.
Being dragged by, I think, Sir Sagamore.
Yeah, that's right. That was about 10 years ago.
And Butch Londrigan beside him trying to help him out. And I think it took him over the fence, and then he freed himself. But that was crazy. And then Andrew Payne, of course.
My mate Andrew Flip, who's now a freelance, I think, but he was with the Herald Sun. He was the only photographer who was in the right place at the right time, and he got the sequence of photos of Andrew Payne and Jason Patton and whoever the other jockey was, and the transition and all that sort of stuff. And I remember being at his place one night. We had this, you know, when you present photos in that long stretch, that panorama stretch, and we're trying to think of the name we should give, because he was going to sell them as keepsakes. The Great Jockey Switch is what we came up with. And I don't know whether he made his fortune out of that or not, but he had a great sequence of photos.
He should have. His problem was it was also on video, which it probably was the most worldwide Australian event in racing for that decade.
Yep, and there's just freaky things involving horses. There was obviously Gallywood was the first one to rise like Gallywood, and then there was that Grand National Steeplechase at Ballarat last year or the year before where there was a similar thing where they thought the horse was dead and then it rose. But the best one was Bannerstrand at Warrnambool, of freaky things that happened jumping into suburbia. And I could tell you a story about that photo, Ben, too, is... Sharon Chapman took the photo, and she took this vast panorama, and then when she blew it up, at the corner of it, she saw Bannerstrand jumping over the fence into the housing estate.
So, but you know what's great about stories like these guys? I just think they take racing outside of racing. I mean, that story was on the national news, that Cowra story the other night. Yeah. So all of a sudden you get non-racing people saying, wow, have a look at that. You know, and it just you know, lures a few more people in and just gets racing outside its bubble a bit, doesn't it?
And that's what's going to happen with this drone shot that racing.com, you know, racing has got to take itself to the wider public, and it will do that with better camera coverage. Yeah. And, you know, it'll pick up things that hadn't been seen before, and it'll make the news.
Well, that's a good segue, actually, because what made the news in a way, or Four Corners, was something the opposite on Monday night, and we're going to take a break. It's already been well discussed and digested and all that sort of stuff, but we're going to try and have a bit of a more of a reflective look at what it said about racing, whether it was accurate or not, and whether there, and Ben, I know you think that there were some things in there that maybe we can't ignore, so we're going to have a look at that in a minute. It's 20 minutes past nine.
Opinions. Everyone's got one. On RSN 927's The Verdict.
A few comments to set the scene for Four Corners. Matt, just remember, Four Corners is ABC, left-wing propaganda, from Kevin. This is one from the saddle slipping. Omar A. at Morpheville a couple of years ago rode a winner with a severely slipped saddle, from our previous conversation. Back to the Four Corners program. I was disgusted. You know when you don't pre-read these and you just don't know whether it's a swear word or something? Back to the Four Corners program. I was disgusted at the way Giles Thompson portrayed himself in the position he holds. Gutless in his responses. As an owner, this is one of those ones I was talking about. As an owner, I then received an email signed by him on the program and what the racing industry stands for. Just quickly glanced over it. Etc, etc. Not happy with Giles Thompson's performance. Hey, Matty, as an owner, I find it laughable that the Four Corners interview was so far off. Try paying the training and adjustment bills for these well-looked-after animals. I also urge RVL not to take any more money out from the prize money pool. 10% trainer, 5% jockey, 2% jockey trust, and 1% horse homing, leaving owners with 82% and more to be distributed to appease people like Four Corners. So, Danny, it's been a while, and there's been a lot of commentary and discussion, very broad brush, how it just totally misrepresented racing. But now that we've had a few days to have a think about it. What did you take away, if anything, from not just the episode, but maybe even the reaction?
I watched it with great interest, and I was really hoping for an in-depth Four Corners-like study of the Smurden case, and it just petered out. And then we had a hodgepodge of all issues that had no two sides to the story. And I just didn't quite understand it. It left me really scratching my head. Now, I was more disappointed in Four Corners, which is a show that I like to watch and know how they cover things so well. They certainly do other things, but they don't do racing well. They didn't do the dog industry well either.
Well, I reckon, I mean, in terms of quality TV, it was right up there with sort of Love Island and Gogglebox. Mm-hmm. It was just terrible. But the one thing I will say...
What makes you think Love Island's terrible?
The one thing I will say is it doesn't mean, just because they've made a hash of it, it doesn't sort of mean there's nothing to see here, you know, let's just move on. I mean, the central question to all of that is, you know, that they were trying to get at, that they never really answered, is why wasn't Robert Smurden's phone seized, imaged, forensically examined? And that question still hasn't been answered, I don't think, to anyone's satisfaction. So look,
Bailey admitted in retrospect he probably should, but at the time they didn't know what they had. They didn't, if you think of it in real time, what we know now, fine, but
yeah,
at the
but
time,
hang
they
on.
Weren't really sure what
hang
they
Hang on. They hang on to Greg Nelligan's mobile phone, did they not? And they got, you know, I think 80,000 all up. I think about 17 of them were potentially relevant text messages.
They also had the right to call Smurden's phone in at a later date, even 2 weeks later, as soon as they'd sort of got some interesting stuff.
And the other point,
they didn't need to when they had Nelligan's, because they had it all on Nelligan's phone from Smurden.
Well, the other point here is, Matty, too, is, I mean, it's all right to say, oh, this was just a spur of the moment thing, it happened, we didn't know what was going on. But, I mean, they themselves say that they were very much on the scent of something going on at Aquanita for many years. Mm. So let's not pretend this was just something that came out on race day. I'm not saying that there's anything amiss there, but that is one question.
But it was negligence from the stewards, but there wasn't anything more to it. You can't say, well, why didn't...
I'm not suggesting there is. I'm just saying that question has not been sufficiently answered.
It's damning for stewards to be negligent. Don't you think?
Yeah, no, I take all that, and yes, there was that lingering question and things like that. There were other things that were just the most bizarre links, like the trainer in west of Sydney in New South Wales who's got this string of cheap, slow horses, who's moaning that she can't compete because city trainers are racing for her prize medal. So what? You don't have to train horses if you can't compete.
That just smacks of Four Corners trying to find problems within the racing industry, and someone and feeding the them a line, and they've followed it. And the tongue ties.
The tongue ties. Someone texted me after that and said, "Do those Four Corners realise these horses get gelded, some of them as well? Imagine if they find out that."
But I became sceptical of Four Corners years and years ago when they did the Nicolick one, the summer smoking aces and all that sort of stuff. And I remember thinking how poorly linked things were, and how it and things made no sense, and these big assumptions and things like that. And even when they do stories on fracking in New South Wales and stuff, I have learned to be sceptical about the assumption we always had that Four Corners delivered stories with enormous balance and integrity. I've been doubtful about that.
Yeah, I was phone called. I was called by Four Corners for this story, and after having a half an hour discussion with the person on the other end of the phone, I just sort of decided I'm not interested in going on because, despite I answered all the questions and we had a discussion about the industry, and I felt that they weren't listening to me and that they had an agenda, and that's why I was disappointed with the way they did go that way.
It was like, to me watching, it was like they were trying to say racing was bad. That was the whole emphasis of the show. Racing is bad. And they were trying to sort of justify that stance, but it didn't really get anywhere.
Zach Burton's going to join us in a sec, but just one last thing on it too. Like, does it give you an indication of where racing's at, that they can just throw random mud and think that it will still stick without... The only scrutiny... that they would have been ready for scrutiny within the racing bubble, because of course they would, but outside the racing bubble, what effect may this story have had, just to confirm previous suspicions?
It'll have an effect because while the racing people that are intrinsically involved in it didn't like the story, felt it was biased, Joe Blow is probably about 75% or 80% of the public won't see it that way.
Yeah, I disagree. I watched it with my wife, who knows a little bit about racing, but not much. And the thing that she said to me afterwards, she said, "You know what I learnt from that story, darling?" I said, "No, what's that?"
Did she call you darling?
Yeah, she does. She does.
Jeez.
She said, "Now I know what Peter Vallandis looks like with a beard and without a beard." Mm. That was her takeout from the whole show.
And Jack Burton might have a take on this as well, because he's a good observer of these things on Twitter, whether Peter Vallandis does indeed look better with a beard or not. But Jack's got much more on his plate than all of that sort of stuff. What a titanic struggle it was for the season, and it captured everyone's imagination. Joe versus Zach, and Zach came out on top, and Zach joins us. How are you, Zach?
Well, thank you.
Vallandis with a beard or not with a beard? What do you reckon?
Neither?
What's option
C?
How are you feeling after a tough season coming out on top?
Yeah, I feel exhausted, to be honest. It's been a long season. I've had the weight of expectation on my shoulders for quite a bit of time now. You know, every minute of every day, every decision I made was always going to count. Every time an owner and a trainer asked me for a ride, you've always got to, you know, think, is it the right one? Should I wait for a different one? The pressure's on for the entirety of the season. It's not like you're just going for a derby or a cup, just one race, and you have the build up to it for a few weeks before, and then you drop off after it. So it's been a long season. It's one that I've enjoyed, but I must say I'm glad it's finally over.
Zach, it's interesting you say you're exhausted, which I'm absolutely sure you are, but I remember talking to you about a year or so ago, and you know, I asked you whether you would entertain coming back to Australia at one point, and you basically said, "No, look, you know, it's such a great lifestyle over here. You know, we ride 2 days a week. I get to spend a lot of downtime with my family." And the point of the story was you were quite worried about the amount of racing in Australia and potentially a lot of Australian riders sort of getting burnt out and fatigued. I mean, is that, you know, looking from afar, is that still an issue? And I'm assuming that you're quite happy where you are for that very reason, I guess.
I think in Australia, yeah, it is still an issue. And I suppose now that we're at the end of the season, at holiday time, of course, I'm going to feel a little bit flat because it's all over. But you don't get that luxury in Australia. I quickly realised when I come to Hong Kong how burnt out I was as a jockey in Australia from just the amount of travelling that you do, even for track work and barrier trials. It's every day. It's relentless. It's all over the place.
Even back in the old days when you were with Robert Smerdon, you had a fatigue issue, didn't you?
Yeah, at that time I was probably not handling my weight that well. I was doing it the wrong way, as you do when you're young and inexperienced and trying to ride a little bit too light. And I was getting the better of me. Once I put my weight up a little bit more, things become a little bit easier. But that doesn't take away from the fact that the relentless drive of racing in Australia just day after day after day certainly takes its toll. And I notice a lot of the jockeys in Victoria, more so now than other parts of Australia, they set specific times of the year that they take off so that they can have that holiday and recharge and give their body a break. A lot of jockeys, unfortunately, don't have that luxury, and they just got to keep banging on with what they do.
Yeah. Hey, how do you handle the superstardom over there? Hats Aitken was telling me a story about when Joe Marrera and Ryan Moore, before an international series, they were just having a little kick of a soccer ball in a little suburban park over there, and then before you knew it, there was 1,000 people or something because they were so famous, and then they asked for a tip and it had an effect on the betting pool. So with you, I know Joe's probably the glamour presence over there, despite you knocking him off, but how do you handle the being so well known and all eyes on you when you go out over there?
Well, I've been here for 11 years now, so you get used to that type of thing. And to be honest, they're not too bad. They're usually pretty respectful. Although every day you walk down the street, there's definitely at least one or two people that will pull you up for a photo. And every time you go to a hotel or things like that, all the doormen will say hello and good luck. It's the same at restaurants and whatnot else. But it's not over the top. It's nice to know that you have that support. Of course, you'd rather them wanting a photo than wanting to kick you as you walk past, so it's a good problem to have.
Can you give us a bit of an insight into your, I suppose, working relationship with Joe? I mean, are you mates, not mates, get on, don't get on? I know there's a fierce rivalry there. Like, what you know, how does that work? But you know, you're both striving for the same thing. Does it get a bit edgy at times, or are you good mates?
No, we've always got along very well. Joe and I sit next to each other at Sharky every Sunday, so we've had plenty of time to have a good talk about many things, and you know, outside of racing as well as in racing. We see each other every day at the track. We basically live in the same building. So we've had that sort of friendship off the track, but on the track, of course, it's very competitive. We both go out there, and it's been quite a tactical battle between both of us. We've both always been aware of where the other jockey is in a race at all times. And, you know, you go out there, you know, trying to not one-up each other, but trying to make sure you get on top of the other boat.
Talk about Marrera moving on and a few others in a sec. The landscape's going to be so much different next year, but just the volatility of the environment over there. We all know about Chris Muntz and now Nashawilla and so on, and the caution you have to have about who you talk to and when and where and monitoring and so on, and that the punters are so passionate over there. You mentioned that the doorman always says g'day, but have you ever copped any grief over there as well for getting rolled on a favourite from punters? Is it a bit volatile on a number of fronts over there?
I've been pretty lucky, actually. Sometimes on a race day, if Joe or Douglas were, when he was at his top, would get beat on a hot pot halfway through the day, the crowd would absolutely give it to them in the parade ring the next race. But fortunately, I've escaped that. But walking around the streets and things like that, the Chinese aren't confrontational like that. They'd rather bicker behind your back than say it to your face.
Oh, that's a good way to go. Hey, next season, now, I might be wrong about what. So Nash, you know, I don't think he's going to be a factor. Joe's moving on to Japan. Tommy Berry's coming home. Brett Prebble didn't get his contract renewed, so he'll be coming home. Was Olivia Pellier over there as well?
Olivia Deleuze was the other.
Sorry, Olivia Deleuze. I think it was one of them. So he's not there as well. It's a big blow to the overall jockey ranks with all those jockeys not being there next season, isn't it?
Yeah, there's definitely a changing of the guard. We have two young jockeys from South Africa coming to join the roster as well, and there'll be another English jockey that will come and join us from mid-October. So that'll be three new spots, but no doubt they've got their eyes open, and they'll be looking for someone else to come and join us as well.
That was fascinating, I think, what you said there, Zach, about really knowing where Joe was, you know, in pretty much every race. Was it really at that extent that the battle between you two is so big, you're sort of, not so much you're obviously riding to win your horse, but you were very, very mindful of where he was in a race?
Well, the problem was most of the time he was on the favourite. He was on the second favourite. So, you know, as a jockey, you need to be aware of where the favourite runners are in every race. And it just happened to be that he was always on one of them.
Hey, just before we let you go, you're losing so many megastars. When you look ahead to next season and the challenges you're going to have to win this premiership again, who do you think might be your biggest threats?
It's a difficult one. I'm not sure where it's going to come from at the moment. We do have a good group of great young riders here. The Jockey Club, let's not forget, go around the world and cherry pick who they think are the best riders to be able to come and compete here. So it's not going to be a walk in the park. they can all ride. They come here with great CVs, and you know most of them that are here can ride light. So once again, I'm going to be against the odds, trying to do it the hard way, having to ride at a higher, heavier weight than them. But you know, Teton's had a great season. Chad Schofield's had a great season. Neil Callan has done well. Sam Clipperton hasn't had much support this year, but you know, next season he could get that support now that the door is open. So any one of those jockeys could put their hand up. But I think when the English jockey comes, he's probably going to be my biggest competitor. He can ride light. He's been here before and he's had some success. So I'm expecting him to do well.
What's his name, the English?
Well, the club hasn't released it, so I doubt they're going to let me release it. I'll let them put out the rules.
You're giving the Invisible Man a nice description anyway. Hey, Zach, well done. You might not be aware of it from up there, but down here, this Marrera Purton thing has been just a massive ongoing story and something for us to look forward to on the weekend. So thanks for giving us something to be really interested in, and congratulations. It's a massive feat to knock off Joe Marrera, so well done.
No worries. Thank you very much.
Zach Purton there. Yeah, it's a good story, isn't it? Because I remember Smurden telling me years ago when Zach was with him, he said, this is the most gifted kid, but he said he just gets tired all the time. So he got through all that, Dan.
He did, and he went there unheralded virtually to Hong Kong. He'd reached a level here which was promising but hadn't reached the level, say, of a James McDonald. Mm. And next minute he's over there, and he just built his own life, and I think his dedication has been the key to it. And,
absolutely.
Yeah. Where else in the world would you come to the last meeting with effectively a four-win lead and still be worried that the other bloke's going to knock you off?
Well, the other bloke's a pest, you know. So
it's interesting, the Nashua Willup, you mentioned there. It's all gone very quiet on that front, hasn't it? I heard a little bit of a whisper on the weekend. Someone mentioned he might be back in Australia. I don't know whether that's right, but that has gone very quiet. So it'll be interesting to see what transpires there.
Tragic situation. Hey, we've got a lot to get through, and we've got a few big ticket items that I still want to talk about, including the Everest, but I want to reflect on the tenure of Mike Simons at the MRC. I reckon, I'm not sure, 8 or 9 years, I think, or 7 or 8 years, he was the chairman, and he made the transition at a media call on Friday to Peter LeGrand, who was obviously a senior committeeman there. So Mike Simons, Brody Arnold left 6 months or so ago, so the Arnold-Simons duo has moved on. I wanted to reflect back on the Mike Simons era, and just my snapshot of it was overwhelmingly positive. Some of the innovations and the business type decisions they made, and the way they switched things around at the MRC and made it the most vibrant club. And you know, even free entry on days where other clubs wouldn't even consider, and all that balance of what they did. There were a few things they did. They flew a few kites that didn't land. I remember the push for a Wait for Age Caulfield Cup. And Mike even said to me in the committee room one night when he conceded, he said, you know what, I think we misread the importance of the handicap of the Caulfield Cup. So I don't think that's going to ever happen. But they didn't like the fact that the Caulfield Cup was falling behind the other two big races. They didn't like criticism of certain additions that they were down on form. I think they've pulled their heads in on that one. The last race feature didn't work, and they pulled their heads in on that, and the idea of 30-minute gaps on Saturdays. But they were.
They had a dip.
They had a dip.
I think Mike's been tremendous for racing in general, because he's very approachable, and I think he gave it a bit of a younger slant, even though he's probably not that young.
And aggressive too.
Aggressive business type. He also a punter, which I think is not a bad
thing.
Aquinita, did he wait too long with his many hats? Should he have symbolically almost done the right thing when the Aquinita thing blew up, because he was MRC chairman on the board of Aquinita? Was he pushing his luck for too long with that?
Well, it's a little bit of a hard one, isn't it? I mean, I had a beer with him in Brisbane during Stradbroke Week, and I asked him point blank. I said, did you have any knowledge of, you know, what was going on? And he looked me in the eyes and said, absolutely not. He said, the first thing that I knew was when...
I believe him, but that's what he would say.
You know, correct. But I guess what I'm saying is, you can't, if that's what he's saying, I guess you've got to take it at face value. So why should he step aside?
I think it's a conflict of interest.
No, but it wasn't that. It was the conflict of interest.
I think it's a conflict of interest that racing officials need to look at in the future. You know, when they go on to run race clubs and or on join Race Victoria, they've got to
That's a fair
really
point.
Step aside from other realms of racing that they might be involved in. Like some people say they shouldn't even own horses. Like you get situations where there's a dispute over a chairman
and
having a runner in a Melbourne Cup or something like that.
And Aquinita was a tenant. There was a lot of threads to the conflict, I thought, you know. And I believe him too. But I also believe that what else would he say? Because I reckon that if Robert Smerdon was topping up horses to get an advantage for a very powerful climate like Mike Symonds, he'd want Mike Symonds to think it was because he was a great trainer, not because he was a cheating trainer. So I don't subscribe to the view that, of course, Mike Symonds had to know, because why would he have to know?
Yeah, no, I agree. One thing I think was a big tick for me too that we didn't reference was a relaxed racing. You know, people can come to the races and not wear a tie, not wear suit pants. That's the future of racing to some extent. It's all very well getting dressed up for the Melbourne Cup and those big days. We understand, you know, that, but why should, you know, someone, a 21-year-old kid, why should he have to go out and buy a suit and spend $800 on flash pants or whatever to go to the races? To me, that relaxed racing, I really hope it takes off.
I don't know whether it translated into bigger crowds, though.
Not necessarily.
No, they consolidated the carnival. They fiddled with the races. They've taken the 1,000 guineas off the Wednesday and, you know, they've fiddled with the races. I think they've done well in that. And I think his legacy, disappointingly, that it'll be shaded by Aquinita.
Should he have walked earlier? That's the question.
Possibly, but
well, that's a fence sitter.
Well, we have to sit on the fence, don't we? And we don't know exactly
Of the conflict of interest. When the Aquinita thing blew up, should he have said, "You know what? I better bail out here while this is all being"?
You answer your own question. What do you think?
Yeah, he should have.
Yeah, I think it's a fair case to say he should have. And the other point, I think his legacy, he's going to leave the Caulfield Cup, I think, in very good shape, despite wanting to tinker with it. $5 million this year is already proven to attract probably more internationals targeting that race and not even interested in the Melbourne Cup. I know there's at least two Japanese horses that are coming just for that race and not something else.
Brody Arnold said something to me once, and it reflected the view that he and Mike had, and I reckon it was really accurate. This is about 6 or 7 years ago. We are going to turn this joint upside down. Not turned upside down, but we're going to be so innovative and creative and so on, because we don't want to see racing wither on the vine and then make these decisions too late. And I think that's the most commendable thing about the Brody and Mike combo, was that they were prepared to take on this idea that you can't be complacent.
I think Peter LeGrand comes from the same ilk. You know, I think he'll carry on the rig.
Fair enough.
The level.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see what happens there. We might take a break. We're going to talk. Danny, you will bring more to the table on this than any of us. Naturalism, the best horse Richard Freeman ever had anything to do with. Jockey's Paywall. Ben, I know you're all over this. And we will have a little look at how the Everest is coming together as well. So a lot more to discuss with not much time to do it. It's 13 minutes to 10.
RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents The Verdict.
10 to 10, and we've got a couple of interesting things to talk about. And one of them, Benny, is the potential jockey pay war. And it looks they want more money. We don't know how much more they want, but they might even get a bit militant. Is that right?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a really interesting one to follow in the next couple of weeks. Basically, their riding fees in Victoria are set at $200 at the moment. The jockeys want more money, basically because of the increase in twilight and particularly night meetings, which I think have increased threefold since the last enterprise bargaining agreement was struck. Now, the new EBA basically has to be inked by August 1. And the two sides, Racing Victoria and the Victorian Jockeys Association, are absolutely, I can tell you, poles apart on this. Matt Hyland from the VJA on Saturday went into the jockeys' room after race four at Caulfield, sat down with all the jockeys there to brief them. Des O'Keefe from the AJA did the same thing at Wodonga. And look, there's still 2 weeks to go. I'm not saying there will be strike action. I'm saying don't completely rule it out, because they are, I will tell you, they are very united on this, the jockeys.
Well, they want to be careful, because I remember they threatened to strike over the new whip rules a few years ago. And in retrospect, that was just stupid petulance from them, because the whole world would agree that the whip had to be reformed to a degree. So that was the last time they thought about striking. And one of the things I'll say about they think they need more money because of night and day racing, so by competing in these more race meetings, they are getting more paid more anyway. Because whenever they go to a, oh, I'm going to Pakenham tonight on a Thursday night, I didn't used to, I'm in a position to earn more money for every ride. So they're effectively getting paid more by more racing anyway. If yeah, they opt
really
to play.
Run the risk if they strike of alienating the industry against them, and it's not a good. It just doesn't work.
I don't think they will strike. I'm just saying, don't completely rule it out.
Is there merit in their claim?
Oh, look, it's a hard one because I don't know exactly, and they won't say exactly what sort of an increase they're looking for. So without knowing exactly what sort of an increase they're looking for, it is hard to work out the merits of it. But one thing I will say is, and just talking to Zach Purton before, for instance, who rides, you know, 2 days a week basically in Hong Kong, there are a lot of fatigued, absolutely exhausted jockeys with a seat out of their pants that drive all around, you know, Victoria to track work, trials, you know, races, twilight races, night races. And yes, the top ones get compensated very well, good prize money. You know, the top 10 probably live in flash mansions. Yeah, we get that. But it's probably the level a couple of tiers underneath that. That are just driving around everywhere with the bums out of their pants that I do feel a bit sorry for. And having talked to quite a few of the lower tier ones, fatigue and burnout and exhaustion really is an issue.
Simply because there's not enough jockeys to service the industry. So basically, they've got to go to these meetings. If every jockey said, I'm going to have 2 days off during the week, you wouldn't be able to run the industry.
No, and I agree with that.
And they're only bringing in, I think this year, 6 new kids.
Yeah.
And maybe extra money will entice kids to come into the industry. And I'd believe they deserve more. I don't know how much more.
See, Racing Victoria have sort of countered this by saying, well, hang on, we're not giving you more money because there's been prize money increases in the last few years. So, you know, you're getting more prize money for winning rides and running second. But the VJA are saying, well, hang on. I mean, a lot of those top-level races, you know, being won by, if you had the likes of Winx and horses from Sydney, jockeys
but
from
But lower-level
Sydney.
Races have gone up too.
Oh, they have, but obviously not proportionally as much.
Well, it's like life. It's life, isn't it? You know, not everyone. It's not communism. Anyway, but Des O'Keefe has just texted me, reminding me that running 10th at Wodonga doesn't get you a lot of money, and there was 2 exclamation marks. So, you know, fairly forceful. But I agree.
Was it in capital letters? That's what I wanted.
No, there was no capitals, thank God. And no emojis, which is good. But I agree with Des too, because I'm very jockey sympathetic. A lot of mates were jockeys and so on, and I know how risky it is.
You've given that impression. Jockeys,
you spend half your life bagging them. What are you talking about?
Yeah, very sympathetic. Please. Short shelf life, very dangerous. But it's all about the balance of what they're asking for and what's reasonable given prize money.
And I get the feeling that, as with a lot of these sort of pay disputes, there'll be a lot of huffing and puffing and pushing on both sides. And
fist slamming.
There probably will be a compromise reach, but let's hope there is.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, that's that. But if they strike, I think Des would agree. You don't win when you do that. You get very unpopular. Danny, I remember Naturalism, and he's, you know, when you think of the great Friedman horses, you think of Super and Scalacci and whatever, Maccabi.
Yep.
But Naturalism was the great talent, wasn't he? And he was the wait for age superstar.
Right in the middle of when Lee and the boys are at their peak. I joined them in just after the Cox Plate in 92, after he'd had the fall. And
aged quickly in a short period of time.
I did, yes. Yeah. I was there 4 years, and Naturalism was there for probably about 18 months of that period. So he was great to have around, but wonderful horse. And I just thought it was interesting that Richard tweeted after his death at the age of 29 the other day. That
after Naturalism's death, not
Richard's. No, and Richard's still alive and kicking.
He tweeted from his deathbed.
Yeah. That it's the best horse he had anything to do with, which is a huge compliment because everybody, when people talk about Lee's best horses, they don't often put Naturalism because he didn't win that Cox Plate that he should have won. He fell.
He was 6-4 favourite in the hottest Cox Plate of all time. Don't forget that's how dominant he'd been. He was a hot favourite in that race.
He was, and Dippman said he was bolting at the time, and he won virtually every way for age race leading up to it. Then he went to Japan, and he had a good. Richard took him to Japan and looked after him and trained him up for the Japan Cup. And he had that hoof injury and was beaten in the neck by a champion.
Mm.
Like, one of the great performances. And when he went to stud, interestingly...
He was crap at stud, wasn't he?
No, well, his first crop, he had a winner in Sydney, and then he had True Blonde, a crack filly who won during the Flemington Carnival that Lee trained. And he was super popular. at Magic's Magic Million sales following January. You couldn't buy them. They were just through the roof. Ridiculous.
He was by Palace Music, wasn't
he? By Palace Music, out of a very good Zephyr Bamey. But he... By Easter, he was dead in the water. He hadn't had another winner.
Yeah, yeah.
And he had a few. Natural Destiny was a Queensland horse of great ability.
Grey horse?
Greyish horse.
Being a narc by any means, great horse. But to some extent, you think people kind of half remember him most for that Cox Plate?
They do
a
bit.
When he was raging favourite.
Two defeats. One he fell and one he had a sore hoof in Japan. Yeah. Just a couple of tweets. Why should jockeys' wages increase when wages are stagnant elsewhere? I believe there is considerably more interest in English racing than Hong Kong. The English stayers actively target our cups. Did you see the win of Charlie Appleby's Hamada on the weekend? Looks a serious stayer from Hariba. All right, well, that's that. Just a quick one on the Everest. And if this horse comes, US Navy flag, who won the July Cup, it's a massive coup for Racing New South Wales, ATC, to get the glamorous overseas horse that they didn't get last year.
And that and Wesley Ward's horse, Bound for Nowhere, who hasn't got a slot yet.
Mm.
Two seriously good horses. One, one's won a July Cup and was a champion two-year-old. That's US Army US Army flag.
US Navy flag.
Navy flag. And the other horse, Bound for Nowhere, ran third and was a little bit stiff because he was all over the place in the King Stand. So he's a seriously good horse. But it'd be interesting to see what slot he can get. Ward said he's coming irrespective. The spin-off will be that both horses might stay on for the Darley because Coolmore will want to establish that horse as a
bit of collaboration between
real shuttle
horse. Yeah.
Real shuttle horse. So I think... it's taken the Everest to a new level.
I'm happy to keep bagging it, but I'm running out of ammunition.
Well, I'll tell you what isn't interesting too. Just overnight, there was another little snippet dropped at this new race, the Kosciuszko, the little sister or the little cousin to the Everest.
Call it the Bogon.
it's worth a million in itself, race for sort of bush horses, which will be on Everest Day. So that, I suppose everyone was bagging the Everest as being the rich man's race and all. That was the big knock on it to start with. But I guess having this race for the bush battlers on the same day is a nice little thing, isn't it?
Softens the image, doesn't it? Yep. If everyone does think that about the Everest, then it's nice to have this race that's the, So, yeah, I agree with all that.
Yep.
What's happening this week in your lives, boys? Anything big happening?
Got an edition of Inside Racing going to press today. So,
what's in that?
Oh, it's some great stuff written by me.
Yep. And any subject in particular to
not that
promote?
I can remember.
No,
a bit of a summary of the year and a look to the spring with the horses. Just as we discussed some of the horses that have from left of field, but done with myself and Stephen Howell, who subs my copy and puts the words back in that I leave out. And I have 11 words out of my copy.
All together. Just a
the and a two and a it, and they're gone.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to getting that out, and I'm probably going to have a quiet week after that. Probably go and sit in the wine bar and hope Steve Moran pops in down at Tookaroo.
Lord Lucan, you mean? Steve Lauren. Benny, what's...
I'm on the holiday countdown, boys. I've got 2 more weeks left, but there are a few interesting things in the next couple of weeks going on in racing. I'm really fascinated to see next week, Jamaica, the Caulfield Cup winner, is going to have a jump out at Caulfield. What a remarkable story that will be if she returns to racing. She was nearly dead. That's extraordinary.
Nearly killed her trainer.
Also next week, the Aquanita matter. I think there'll be a few more headlines. That is back for sort of further legal argument at VCAT with Smurden now with his appeal. So just a few interesting things to keep the news pages ticking along.
Absolutely. Good on you guys. Thanks for popping in. Michael Falgate's back in the studio tomorrow after